Hello, welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, January 13th, 2006, and this is show number 38. I am Bob Hayes, your host for the show. Today's episode of MotoGP OD is brought to you by WI Synoil. WI Synoil is an independent AMSOIL dealer. No one can match AMSOIL's experience and technological know-how in the field of synthetic motor oil and lubricants, and no one delivers products like AMSOIL. Except no substitutes, AMSOIL is the first in synthetics, and WI Synoil can help you with all your AMSOIL needs. You can find WI Synoil on the web at wisynoil.com. All right, we've got a full show today. There's a few news items that we're going to be covering, and then after that I'll have the third installment of our tech segments. Today we're going to be continuing our journey up the motorcycle, and we're going to talk about suspension. This is suspension part one. It's going to be divided into at least two parts. It's just such a big topic. So today is part one, covering the history of motorcycle suspensions and some alternatives to the telescopic fork that we all know and love. Before all that, you may have noticed that there's a link on the MotoGP OD website for a survey. And you're going to kind of hear me mention this a few times in the next couple of months. But if you haven't done the survey yet, please, you know, take about 5 minutes out of your time to participate. It's completely private, and it's just going to help me learn a little bit more about the audience, and I'd really appreciate it. Okay, moving on. Alert MotoGP OD listener Alan Litchfield in the UK sent me a link to a nice little resource that's on the internet. The BBC has a combined calendar for MotoGP, World Superbike, AMA, and British Superbikes. And it's kind of handy. Tells you everything that's on, you know, in a specific month, even if a couple of the AMA dates are a tad off because of the closure of Pikes Peak. I'll put a link to that on the website of, you know, MotoGP OD website. And thanks very much to Alan to send it in. Next, I got a tip from another alert listener, Ross Flewell-Smith in Australia. And Ross and I have been exchanging some emails lately. And in one of them, he passed on a little story about Valentino Rossi turning down a $5 million endorsement for shoes because, get this, he likes to wear Nikes. Unfortunately, Ross couldn't find the exact place that he'd read that story, and then I couldn't verify it. I couldn't find anything about it on the web. But it's a cool story in itself, and it makes for a, you know, nice little anecdote. And it also makes you think that, you know, Rossi just spent $5 million to wear Nikes. So it just must be nice. And then, yet another alert listener, Kurt Lee Amstutz in Brazil, sent me an interesting statistics inspired by the comments that I had made last show about the prices of sport bikes in Taiwan. And Kurt writes, last week, the official Suzuki importer for Brazil announced via a fanfare press release the new price for the 2006 GSX-R 1000. The suggested retail cost is 71,900 Brazilian reals. The real is trading at about 2.3 per US dollar, making the total cost of that Gixxer around $31,260. That's amazing. And a 2006 R1 sells for about the equivalent of $28,000. So that's a lot of money. And so I was shocked about the prices in Taiwan. I am just floored by the prices in Brazil. And that's, you know, because of the tariffs and so forth. It's just amazing. In any case, well, thank you very much for those emails, guys. I thought that was kind of interesting stuff. And to everybody else that emailed me in the past week, also thank you very much. It was kind of a busy week with email. If you'd like to send in comments, suggestions, whatever, I read it all and I answer them all. My email address is always motogpod@motogpod.com. So, you know, I appreciate hearing from you. All right, an interesting story came out earlier this week, and the saga just kept going on and on and on like a soap opera. There's been a whole lot of chatter about this on the internet already, so you may very well already have heard of it. But if you haven't, you might be surprised to hear that Yamaha announced that they have a new title sponsor, none other than Camel. This is the very same Camel brand owned by Japan Tobacco International that has such a great history sponsoring Mats Biaggi, and they were so upset when Honda wouldn't give Biaggi a ride that they pulled their support from the Honda Pons team and announced that they were going to be pulling out of MotoGP altogether and goodbye, see ya. Well, apparently they changed their minds. I read the first release from Yamaha announcing the sponsorship, and I was pretty amazed, I'll tell you. A week or two ago, I'd read some rumors about the possibility of you know, Camel sponsoring Yamaha, but I thought they were just that, you know, idle rumor. This news just came as a big surprise to me, but it does confirm what we pretty much we're sure of already that Colin Edwards will continue as Rossi's teammate on the official factory team, and that team will now be called Camel Yamaha. Of course, within a couple hours after that release, Altadis, the parent company of Galwaz, issued their own press release in response, saying that Altadis has initiated arbitration proceedings seeking substantial compensation for Yamaha for the damages arising out of what Altadis considers to be a material breach by Yamaha of the company's two-year sponsorship agreement. Altadis wants money to be paid as damages, and they're asking for an order that would prevent Yamaha from working with JTI because Camel is a direct competitor to Galwaz. And, of course, Altadis, being a company of such a giant conscience, regrets the necessity of going to court and blah, 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 blah. But it didn't end there. All this happened on Monday, those two press releases. Then on Tuesday, Yamaha issues another press release, firing back at Altadis. Yamaha stated that they no longer have a sponsorship agreement with Altadis because the previous one was terminated. Which, yeah, with a press release. And then that press release continued on that Yamaha deplores the fact that Altadis' unreasonable actions have frustrated Yamaha's good faith efforts to resolve this matter in an amicable fashion and has seen fit to make its unmerited allegations in a public forum. And, you know, Yamaha can really take the moral high ground on this one. It's pretty bad. Then on Wednesday, surprise, surprise, Altadis fires off yet another press release in reply to Yamaha's reply to their initial press release. In that statement, along with saying that Yamaha are the bad guys, Altadis said they would like motorsports fans worldwide, which that's you people, they'd like motorsports fans worldwide to know that Altadis' commitment to motor racing and MotoGP remains as strong as ever. Altadis sincerely believes that its decision to seek compensation for Yamaha's wrongful conduct is good for the sport. Yeah, it's awesome. It's the best thing. It's been all quiet on the Western Front for about a day, with no new press releases coming out from these two companies, but it's not over yet. Chances are Yamaha is hoping that this whole thing is going to be tied up in court for so long that by the time anything actually comes of it, the 2006 season is going to be history, with another sweep for Yamaha in the books. The situation has also shown us that Rossi doesn't seem to mind riding for a tobacco-sponsored team, despite these earlier stories that we'd heard that, you know, he doesn't want to be sponsored by a tobacco team. And that the speculations that he had put his foot down to Yamaha and said that he wouldn't ride for a Galwaz-sponsored team because it was a tobacco team, that those speculations are, you know, either wrong or that he did so not because Galwaz and Altadis is a tobacco company, but, you know, for some other reason, which, shit, who knows? Maybe it's because with the Camel sponsorship, he's going to be back on a yellow motorcycle in yellow leathers. Or maybe it's because he finally drove the nail in, you know, Max Biaggi's MotoGP career coffin. It's really hard to say. But I think that this whole mess, and especially the way that it's been handled by press releases, has not been a good thing at all. It's cost a lot of sponsorship dollars to MotoGP. It's caused Sito Ponza's team to pull out for 2006. It's made Carlos Checa lose that seat that he had on the Sito Pons team. It's caused problems for Hervé Poncharal of Tech 3 Yamaha because he lost the Fortuna sponsorship due to all this in the very early stages. And it's just made the sport and these companies and the riders pretty much look silly all around. This next one's not specifically about road racing, but it is about motorcycle racing. And I'm very sad to report that Australian Andy Caldicott, riding the number KTM bike in the Dakar Rally, crashed and suffered fatal injuries while racing Stage 9 on January 9th. 250 kilometers into the stage, between Nouakchott and Kiffa in Mauritania, Caldicott had a heavy accident and was killed instantly from head injuries. A medevac helo was on the scene within half an hour, but the doctors pronounced Caldicott dead shortly after arrival at the crashed site. Caldicott was competing in his third Dakar. He had finished sixth place in the 2005 Dakar and was currently 10th overall this year after having won Stage 5 in Morocco. Caldicott crashed close to the spot where two-time winner Fabrizio Maione was killed last year, also riding a KTM. Dakar rally organizers created some new rules this year to improve safety, included speed limits, a GPS system that was enabling each rider to be located and to allow him to communicate with the organizers, and more rest breaks for the riders. Unfortunately, the nature of racing, particularly this kind of racing, is such that it can't be made completely risk-free. And it's just a very, very unfortunate situation. So, right on, Andy. You will be missed. It's old news by now that Max Biaggi is out of MotoGP. He said so on his website, max-biaggi.com, and he's also said that the details of this whole sordid situation will be laid out for the world to see in an upcoming book. I wouldn't hold your breath for that book to be published, but it is looking like we're going to see Max in World Superbikes for 2006, even though Max said at the end of 2005 that he wouldn't ride in Superbike. It's been rumored in quite a few places, including here on MotoGPOD, that Max would probably go to Superbikes, but on Thursday, both Eurosport and Motorsport.com ran stories saying that the deal is done, that Max has signed with Alstari Suzuki Corona to seal that deal. I haven't seen an official press release for that yet, but I think that Eurosport and Motorsport.com are right, because the FIM released their 2006 provisional entry list with all the riders and teams listed and so forth, and there are three rider names that are left as, you know, to be announced. One of those as yet unnamed riders, riding a GSXR 1000 for Team Alstari Suzuki Corona Extra, will certainly be the Roman Emperor himself, Max Biaggi. The team will expand to four riders, with last year's teammates Troy Corser and Yukio Kageyama being joined by Max and 2002 World Supersport champ Fabien Fauré, who was moved up to Superbike because Alstari ended their Supersport effort. Joining Max and the other MotoGP refugees will be Alex Barros, who is also not named on the provisional list, but will be riding a CBR 1000RR for Team Claffey Honda alongside Max Neukirchner. The story is on the Team Claffey website and on Max Neukirchner's official website, so somebody seems to know something about it for sure. So I'm not sure why the FIM left old Barros off the list, but he's going to be riding for Team Claffey on a Honda. And MotoGP.com, the official MotoGP website, is reporting that Carlos Checa is hoping to stay in MotoGP after being screwed out of his ride by the whole Pons issue with Pons' abrupt exit from the 2006 season, and that he hopes that an opportunity comes from the Tech 3 Yamaha team, where Checa would be alongside James Ellison, riding Yamaha on some tasty Dunlops. It doesn't sound like a very strong possibility, but you never know, and it was on the MotoGP.com website, which is kind of interesting. Surely Checa would bring some money from Spanish sponsorships, and stranger things have certainly happened. I think that they do, you know, they want to keep the numbers up, they want to keep Checa in the sport, so they're probably going to be doing, you know, everything they can, Dorna and everybody else involved, to try to make that happen. So we'll just kind of have to see what happens on that one. And the last little bit of where are they now news is that Franco Battaini, who rode for WCM last year, as you'll remember, will also be moving to World Superbike. He signed with Team Bertocchi to ride a Kawasaki ZX-10R. This brings the total of 2005 MotoGP riders that have gone to World Superbikes for 2006 to six. Bayless, Chaus, Rolfo, Barros, Biaggi, and Battaini. So there's been a lot of turnover in MotoGP this year. But, you know, look how many of these guys are old. All the B names, Biaggi, Battaini, Barros, and Bayless, are all well into their 30s. And we've had this discussion before, and I've been somewhat caught out that, you know, just being old doesn't necessarily mean you're ready to go. Hell, you know, I'm almost 40. But, it's a young man's sport, and it's time for the young guys to come up. And that's actually just what's happening with Stoner, Pedrosa, Depunier, Vermeulen, all coming into MotoGP this year. So it's going to make some good racing in both series, I really think. I'm very much looking forward to seeing Max mix it up, you know, with guys like Noriyuki Haga. I kind of still wish that Max had come over to the AMA. I think that would have been hilarious. But World Superbikes is going to be very good stuff next year. They're getting a lot of good riders. They've got a lot of good teams going on. A lot of parity in the bikes. It's going to definitely be some interesting stuff. Most of us are motorcycle owners, and we all know that motorcycles require special engine oil because the oil is typically shared by the engine and transmission, and a motorcycle places much higher demands on oil than a car engine does. But what you might not know is that not all motorcycle oils are created equal, and I'm a victim of this myself. I always figured if I bought a major name brand of oil formulated for motorcycles, well, you know, one was pretty much the same as any other. Then I read this AMSOIL white paper, the study of motorcycle oils, that Andy White from WI Synoil sent me, and I will tell you, it made a believer out of me. AMSOIL compared motorcycle oils in two different weights from 15 different manufacturers, and the results were actually a little scary. I just kind of wanted to run out there and give my bike some tender loving care. I read how the oil that I'm using might very well be leaving my engine unprotected because it just doesn't withstand the heat and stress that a motorcycle can put on oil. Sure, you know, all this sounds like the usual stuff that any manufacturer might say, but if you read that white paper, you'll see what I mean. It really was amazing stuff. AMSOIL synthetic motor oil is specially formulated for both peak performance on the road and superior protection when sitting idle or in storage. The benefits of AMSOIL synthetics include improved transmission protection, excellent wet clutch performance, excellent corrosion protection, outstanding heat resistance, robust additive levels, and excellent value for cost-effective performance. WI Synoil is an independent AMSOIL dealer. Contact Andy White at wisynoil.com and he can set you up with an order of AMSOIL today. Dump the dinosaur. I know I'm gonna. When I first decided to do these tech segments, I kind of wanted to keep it basic and enough so that it didn't bore the casual fan, but technical enough so that serious fans would, you know, kind of be able to say, oh, wow, you know, I didn't know that, or at least, at the very least, say, you know, oh, wow, I forgot about that, you know, about any given subject. One of the main reasons I decided to do it this way is because, well, I'm not exactly an expert motorcycle mechanic or designer or whatever, you know, myself. I'm just a guy who likes the sport and owns a motorcycle of my own, is interested in finding out stuff out. So when I started doing the research for this whole suspension segment, I was overwhelmed by how much I do not know about the subject. And because of that, I'm going to have to divide suspensions up into at least two parts because it's an overwhelming amount of knowledge, and I'm going to need some help on parts of it. So for this first part, I'm going to talk a little bit about unsprung weight, like I said I would last week, and I'm going to cover some of the historical suspension designs that have been used on racing motorcycles in the past, and I'll touch a little bit on some of the ideas that people and companies have for suspensions, you know, particularly front suspensions we're talking about. Then next week, in part two, we'll have Max McAllister from Traction Dynamics on the show, and he's going to give us some good tech info about modern suspensions that you see in racing today and fill in the gaps in my knowledge. And that's going to be a really good segment. So, for part one, first of all, unsprung weight. In a nutshell, unsprung weight is the mass of your motorcycle's tires, wheels, brakes, and suspension, along with anything that's kind of connected to them. Think of it like this. Most of your motorcycle is supported by the suspension, right? There's a fork or a spring in between, say, the engine and the ground. Well, unsprung weight is the stuff that doesn't get supported by the suspension. So these parts are directly affected by bumps and holes in the road and so forth. So the unsprung weight governs the force of the reaction that you get when these parts hit those bumps and holes because of the inertia associated with that unsprung weight. Basically, you want the suspension to absorb the roughness of the road, right? And it's going to do that by allowing the wheels to move up and down when you hit a bump, while the rest of the motorcycle remains, you know, hopefully more or less stable. Well, if the unsprung weight is too high, it means that that wheel is going to resist moving upwards when you go over that bump, and it will be harder to stop that upward motion once it finally gets going. And, of course, the same goes for down as well. So it's just like pushing a loaded wheelbarrow or something. You know, the heavier it is, the harder it is to get moving, and the harder it is to stop it. High unsprung weight has a negative effect on overall handling ability, which is why you want the lightest possible wheels, brakes, and suspension components, and everything else that makes up the unsprung weight, combined with the correct suspension settings so that what you end up with are tires that are firmly in contact with the ground and a smooth but firm ride. And, you know, hopefully that defines unsprung weight without flogging a dead horse about it. Unsprung weight will continually come up in any discussion of motorcycle suspension or automobile suspension for that matter, so I kind of wanted to make sure that we're all on the same page about it. Now let's cover some of these old-fashioned suspension designs that I was talking about, and these are things that you might hear about a variety of places. So one of the things I found out when I started looking around for more information on all of this is that the front suspension of a motorcycle is an area where, at one time or another, just about every manufacturer seems to have tried something that's totally different from whatever is the norm at the time. And when I wrote this article, I also figured out how hard it is to describe a suspension system using words. So there's a page on MotoGPOD.com with some photos that are going to help clear up any confusion. You can find that. There's a link in the little show notes for this show, and it's motogpod.com/suspensions.php. As far as racing motorcycles are concerned, most of the early Grand Prix racing machines, and, you know, by early I'm talking before World War II, so before the official, you know, FIM Motorcycle World Road Racing Championship Series in 1949, most of these earlier motorcycles used girder forks, often with friction damping instead of any kind of hydraulic damping. And a girder fork is just a solid unit that's attached to the rest of the motorcycle with kind of a parallel link arrangement. So if you've ever seen a set of parallel rulers, like the ones kind of used for navigation on the ship, that's pretty much how it works. One ruler represents the motorcycle steering head, and the other, the top of the forks. And so when I say the girder, you know, is a solid unit, I don't necessarily mean it's one single solid fork leg on each side, because most of those girder forks used lighter weight tubing to make up the entire girder, you know, in sort of a trellis arrangement. But that tubing does not move in relationship to itself, so the girder as a whole is solid. A disadvantage to girder forks is that as the suspension moves, the wheelbase changes, which seriously affects handling. And girder forks are still seen today. For instance, the Confederate Wraith uses a girder fork, and the Britain V1000, which is a motorcycle I'd like to talk about a lot more one day, also used a type of a girder fork. They're also popular with some of the chopper builders, which makes a lot of sense because a telescopic fork is kind of useless after you rake it out like as much as they often do, because the sliders are so bound up that they just don't slide as freely as they should. So that's about the girder forks. Next common type of front suspension in the evolution of the Grand Prix motorcycle is the leading link fork. Now, with a leading link fork, a linkage at the wheel hub connects the springs and maybe a damping system, whether it's friction or hydraulic or whatever, to a static fork leg. As the wheel moves up and down, the linkage pivots, but that static leg doesn't move in comparison to the rest of the motorcycle. So this reduces the amount of change in that motorcycle's wheelbase compared to a girder fork, but it can be unstable at higher speeds. Leading link forks come in a variety of different styles, some with the two sections of tubing running roughly parallel for kind of the entire length of the fork, some with one section and just a shock at the bottom, some with a triangulated sort of arrangement where the sections are at larger angles to each other. Most of the racing bikes with leading link suspensions, at least the ones that I've seen pictures of, used a more or less parallel type of arrangement, and that at first glance it looks a lot like a girder fork. This is often called a springer suspension because you can see the springs at the top near the steering head. Another less common kind of leading link suspension that's really super interesting is the Earl's fork. Earl's forks were patented by a guy named, strangely enough, Ernie Earls, and they eliminate the problem of changes in wheelbase. Basically, you have a leading link fork, but the segment that's attached to the steering head comes down behind the front wheel rather than running parallel to, you know, the hub. A pivoting link goes horizontally from the bottom of that to the wheel hub, and then the third leg of this whole triangular arrangement is a set of shock absorbers. And BMW and MV Agusta both used Earl's forks on racing motorcycles in the 50s. The design of an Earl's fork is also particularly suited for a sidecar because it can reduce steering effort dramatically, and BMW dominated sidecar racing in the 50s using the Rennsport motorcycle with the Earl's fork. However, for a solo machine, the added unsprung weight, there's that term again, the unsprung weight penalty kind of seems to cancel out a lot of any benefits. So, just as girder forks were gradually replaced by leading link forks, then leading link forks were replaced by telescopic sliding forks, similar to that are used in the vast majority of motorcycles today. BMW was the first manufacturer to make a racing motorcycle with hydraulically damped telescopic forks way back in 1935, and they did quite well with that motorcycle. AJS also had a racing motorcycle with telescopic forks in the 30s, but then World War II came along and kind of put motorcycle racing on hold for a while. But after the war, companies started to experiment again, and the 50s and 60s really saw that telescopic fork take over from the leading link. Now, we're going to talk about telescopic forks next week. I'm not going to go into any great detail about them right now, but I do want to mention a couple of other things before we finish this part one of our suspension tech segment, because as with almost everything else, telescopic forks involve compromises, and there's a lot of people that think that there are better solutions than telescopic forks. So we've seen some interesting experiments like, say, the Honda-powered Elf Grand Prix Racer from the mid-80s, the Bimota Tessie, and the Yamaha GTS 1000A civilian motorcycles, all that used a situation called hub center steering. Now, hub center steering means that the front wheel is steered from its hub, from the wheel hub, much like a car, rather than a motorcycle, which is, well, different. Not a telescopic fork arrangement. You're not steering it exactly from the hub. The Elf, the Tessie, and the GTS 1000 are just three of many, many different designs that have tried to do this hub center steering, and each goes about it quite differently. One thing they do have in common is a front swing arm, pretty much like the rear swing arm, except that it doesn't have to deal with the drive chain and everything. It's just holding the wheel and kind of acting as a suspension component. On the Bimota, a double-sided swing arm held the front wheel, and a linkage from the handlebars actually steered the wheel within that swing arm. And there's kind of nothing where the fork would be on a standard motorcycle, just empty space between the fairing and the wheel. So it looks kind of weird in the pictures. There's a picture of it on the website. On the Elf and the Yamaha, a single-sided swing arm was used, and steering input traveled down a leg, which, not, you know, kind of for lack of a better term, that was more or less in the same position that the fork would be on a standard motorcycle. On the Elf, that leg also held a shock absorber. Ron Haslam rode that Elf Honda bike to fourth place in the 500cc championship in 1987, which was only the second year that the bike was competing, which, you know, I kind of think that's not too bad. So I'm not sure why Elf pulled the plug on the whole project after the 1988 season, although Ron Haslam did come in like 11th that year. Yamaha didn't really sell a whole lot of GTS 1000s, although the people that bought them seemed to swear by them. But I think also Yamaha positioned the motorcycle incorrectly. They kind of tried to sell it as a very sporty bike, and it probably should have been more of a sport touring market. It's an interesting motorcycle. And then the Bimota was and still is just a very, very expensive, very unusual motorcycle for people that just really need something unique. They recently brought it back here a couple of years ago with a different engine and so forth. And going to be selling, tiny numbers, something like 30 a year or something like that. And at about $50,000, it's actually still a whole lot less money than one of those cool custom choppers from those guys on TV that you see. And it sure as hell going to get a lot more notice on the street. So might be something to think about. You know, if you got an extra 50 grand laying around, you might want to buy Moto Tizzy. In any case, the world just isn't quite ready for hub center steering right now. But it wasn't too many years ago that the world wasn't ready for telescopic forks or rear suspension of any kind. So you really never know what the future might hold. You know, it's got a lot of distinct advantages to it, and we might see them coming around again. All right, this tech segment just barely touched on some of the different kinds of suspensions that you may hear about and that were used and that have shown up through the years. I didn't talk about some of the things that you think would be obvious, like BMW's telelever suspension or the Saxon Triumph 900 with its SaxTrac suspension, and then the MotoSys, which is using a different fork arrangement again. And I never even talked about rear suspensions at all, so it's all a little bit incomplete. But all that stuff leaves room for future shows, and maybe we're going to talk about those another day. So, like I said, next week we'll be talking to Max McAllister, Traction Dynamics, going to be covering top telescopic forks in great detail, everything you ever wanted to know but were afraid to ask about a telescopic fork on your motorcycle. I'm really looking forward to it, and I think you're going to like it too. That's going to do it for today. Thank you very much for downloading the show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you get a chance, please remember to stop by the MotoGPOD website and do that survey. Like I said, it should only take about 5 minutes or so. It'd be really cool if you did that. Thank you very much to our sponsor for this show, WI Synoil. Don't forget, you can check them out at wisynoil.com. That's spelled out WISYNOIL.com, WI Synoil. And I encourage you to do so. It's an interesting product, and that white paper is just amazing. And then next Friday, we're going to continue our suspension segment talking about telescopic forks with Max McAllister from Traction Dynamics. That's going to be a really good show, so make sure you tune in. And until then, well, so long. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorner Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorner Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGPOD isn't affiliated with any of them.